Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we deem most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. My guests today are Michelle Goldberg, here to talk about the meaning of Paul Ryan and the complementary economic and social components of the right-wing agenda, and Charles Gentica, a Manhattan-based lawyer who handles more bankruptcy cases than anyone else in town, on how more people with debt problems should consider filing. 30 years ago this month, the great bull market in stocks took off. The market hit a peak in the mid-1960s and then languished through the 1970s. Though day-to-day fluctuations in the stock market don't mean much to those who don't hold stocks, that miserable performance in the 70s was a symptom of a real disturbance in normal capitalist class power relations. From an elite point of view, the working class had just gotten too strong in the 60s and 70s, too entitled, and as a result, corporate profits were severely pinched. And the market's performance reflected that. The bourgeoisie rallied, organized, and got Paul Volcker installed as chair of the Federal Reserve. Volcker tightened monetary policy massively, creating the deepest recession since the 1930s, which had a salutary effect. The working class was scared into submission. That bad, demanding attitude of the 1970s gave way to a new deference to the boss that would dominate politics for decades. But the Volcker squeeze also drove a heavily indebted Latin America into crisis as interest rates hit the double digits. From the financial market's point of view, the most serious and threatening symptom of that crisis was Mexico's debt default in August 1982. Fearing that Mexico and its Latin neighbors were about to blow, as Volcker put it, the Fed signaled an end to the long period of tight money and high interest rates that characterized the early 1980s. Short-term interest rates fell from nearly 15% in the summer of 82 to under 9% in the spring of 83. 10-year Treasury bonds fell from over 14% to just over 10% in a matter of months. When the Fed took its foot off the neck of the economy, it revived in a very capital-friendly fashion, and the market showed it. A long bull market in stocks, one that would last until the summer of 2000, interrupted by the occasional crash here and there, and an even longer bull market in bonds, which continues into the present, was underway. Corporate profitability rose dramatically for the next 15 years, and despite some serious cyclical declines, has remained quite high since. The bull run clearly marked a major transformation in the political economy of the U.S. So the stock market should be listened to as a long-term commentator on the economic landscape. But what about shorter-term calls? It's an article of faith among many that the stock market is an excellent forecaster of developments in the real economy. But is that true? Not really. It sometimes calls the beginning and end of recessions, but with lots of false signals mixed in. And even its good calls are not all that far in advance, just a quarter or two. And statistically speaking, the stock market does a worse job of forecasting GDP growth several quarters out than GDP itself does. In other words, you'd do better forecasting the rate of economic growth at year-end just by assuming it's going to be more or less the same as it is now than you would by looking at what the stock market is doing. So the next time some hack sagely tells you that the market is a wise prognosticator, just laugh at him. My first guest is Michelle Goldberg, a writer for Newsweek and the Daily Beast and the author of two books, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, from 2006, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, from 2009. I thought you'd be an excellent person to talk with about the recent rise of Paul Ryan. We know he has it in for Medicare and Medicaid, but what about the rest of him? Michelle Goldberg. Welcome, Michelle. A lot of people's attention has focused on Paul Ryan's rather antediluvian socioeconomic views, particularly his animus to cut Medicare. He's also quite the social conservative, right?
Yeah, I mean, initially it was interesting. Initially there was kind of an assumption that because he's so concerned with fiscal matters that he's kind of indifferent to culture war issues, when often those two things are part of a package on the right. And so his social views are, except for a single vote to ban employment discrimination against gay people, which he does deserve credit for, but on, you know, abortion and birth control and women's health, his views and his votes are indistinguishable from, say, a Michelle Bachmann.
Ayn Rand, who is supposedly his intellectual god, although he's now repudiating her to some degree, but she was quite anti-religious. How does someone like Ryan reconcile this admiration for at least part of Rand's philosophy with the religion?
Well, I think that, you know, the story of the modern right in a lot of ways, is the story of the combination of this kind of very brutal economic libertarianism with social authoritarianism. And my sense is that you can, it only really makes sense if when you hear the word, say, individual from Ryan, substitute individual man or individual father, because essentially they kind of believe in the right of individual men and individual patriarchs to control their own families and their own communities. And so in that sense, on the one hand, you know, taxes and social welfare and the like, they both make it easier for people to live outside of traditional norms and make it harder for, you know, kind of, as they see, hardworking producers. You know, I think one of the concepts that they do take from Ayn Rand is the separation of society into kind of producers and moochers, you know, and it makes it harder for producers to fulfill their breadwinning role and support, you know, their dependent family and children. It doesn't really matter that this world of kind of, you know, working husbands and stay-at-home wives barely exists anymore. It's still the ideal to which they want to, the ideal that they want to remake, that they want to use to remake society. And so you have on the one hand, you know, economic policies that make the nuclear family the only source of social insurance and stability. And on the other hand, social policies that punish anybody who falls outside that norm.
Does Ryan have a position on contraception? Well, he is a Catholic, so he must have a position on contraception. Is it as extreme as his position on abortion?
Well, I think we don't really know what his position on contraception, you know, he hasn't kind of made any statements like Rick Santorum. What we do know is that he co-sponsored a federal personhood amendment. A federal personhood bill, which you'll remember personhood is concept extreme enough that it was defeated in a referendum in Mississippi. It would define a fertilized egg as a human being with all the kind of rights attendant to a human being. And almost all legal analysts, I think, agree that personhood, in addition to banning abortion, would ban many common types of birth control, certainly the morning after pill, IUDs, probably some forms of birth control pills. And it would also severely restrict the practice of IVF. And so, again, he didn't just vote for this bill. He co-sponsored it.
Well, now what drives these folks on this passionate right-to-lifeism, if you want to call it that? I mean, George Gilder wrote very passionately about how contraception and abortion give women too much power over sexuality and deny it from men. Is this what really is behind this passion?
Like Paul Ryan, it's hard to say because he hasn't written a lot of these very heated culture war manifestos. When he has written about it, what to me is fascinating about his writing on abortion is that he doesn't even consider women at all. You know, he wrote this really interesting piece about how he reconciles his extreme anti-abortion views with his economic libertarianism. And one of the things he said is that abortion actually restricts choice because it reduces the number of people out there to make choices. And so, again, what I see is, at least my guess is that it's less animus against women and their autonomy and more a kind of complete disregard. Like, when he thinks of people, he's not thinking of women.
Only men are people?
Yeah, my sense, I mean, I don't think he would say that, but I think that all of his kind of theoretical concepts of the individual and society presume an individual man. And he just, it's not that he demonstrates an animus towards women, it's more that he just demonstrates a complete disregard bordering on oblivion.
Now, as you said earlier, this view of the sexes is really at odds with reality. Something like half of the jobs in the United States today are held by women. This is not, you know, 1900 or 1950 even. What is driving these folks? What is the emotional power behind it? They can't really believe that we can go back 50 or 100 years to those old gender roles. Is it some kind of weird nostalgia, a sense of a world changing that this provides some degree of security to them? What is the emotional power of his politics?
Well, I'm not sure if they believe. I'm not sure. It's hard. I've actually been trying to think recently about what would the world that Ryan wants to create look like, you know, or how does he imagine the world that he's trying to create? Because there's all sorts of things that we kind of can't go back to, right? I mean, we can hardly imagine a world with no social insurance whatsoever, with kind of privatized roads, without a federal highway system. And so, you know, in a way, these are such abstractions, or they're so unrealistic that it can be a little bit hard to get your head around. But I think, you know, to me, one example you might notice, do you remember there was recently an article in the New York Times about two different women who worked at a daycare center, and it looked at the kind of differences between their fortunes and how, you know, one of them was a single mother, the other one was married, the married woman was part of the middle class, and, you know, her children kind of had all these amenities, and the single woman was really struggling. And I think that liberals would read that and say that, you know, kind of how disgraceful that you can work full-time in a fairly responsible position and be good at your job and still be in poverty and have this incredibly tenuous existence. Whereas I think that for many conservatives, what they would like to see is a situation in which the only route to stability is through the nuclear family.
Yeah, you say a daycare center, that itself is a symbol of a fallen world.
Well, you know, and yeah, and it's, you know, another reason why, you know, on the one hand you have, you know, a tremendous amount of hostility towards so-called welfare dependency, which, you know, scarcely exists anymore now that we don't even have aid to families with dependent children. But you actually, you know, and a lionization of people who, you know, work as opposed to mooch, but you have no support for policies that would actually allow people to work, you know, or kind of make it easier for them to work or to work more.
Now, what about the fact that the Republican ticket is a Mormon at the top and a Catholic beneath him? How does the evangelical community view this kind of these strange religions that they're not entirely comfortable with?
Well, I think that they are increasingly comfortable with Catholicism. I mean, the evangelical community was incredibly enthusiastic about Rick Santorum. You know, I think one of the changes in our politics, particularly since the 70s, is that this strategy that kind of early right-wing theorists talked about as co-belligerency, which is that kind of, you know, Catholics and Protestants would put aside their theological disagreements and focus on their common hostility towards feminism and gay rights. That, I think, has come fully into fruition to the point where now I think a lot of Protestants have adopted hard-right Catholic philosophies of natural law, and you see a lot of the most important theorists on the social right are Catholics. Potentially, you could see eventually Mormons being folded into a similar kind of embrace. You know, it's already starting to happen, for example, with Glenn Beck, with a lot of the common efforts against gay marriage. You know, Mormons were major funders of Proposition 8 in California. There's still enough kind of theological exoticism in Mormonism to make Protestants uneasy. And there's also just a huge amount of competition in terms of proselytization and conversion. You know, these are people who are really kind of trying to poach one another's believers. And so you still have a lot of hostility on that level. But I think that Ryan only helps Romney with conservative evangelicals.
So in dealing with heathen like us, they can overcome their differences.
Yeah, exactly. You know, nothing unites people like a common enemy.
From time to time, we hear that the constituency of the Christian right is aging and diminishing. Just the other day, there was a poll that showed that the number of atheists in the United States had quadrupled or something in the last several years. Are they really a fading constituency? Are they these, you know, just rather dropping off with age, or do they are they managing to renew themselves with younger demographics?
Well, I think that they are. They're diminishing, but the rate at which they're diminishing is slow enough that they're still an incredibly potent force. And in a way, you can almost see the kind of growth of atheism and the growth of fundamentalism as symbiotic. You know, as more and more people associate religion with people like, say, you know, Michelle Bachmann or Pat Robertson, they are more likely to reject it. And then similarly, as the culture becomes more secular and more accepting, it creates a greater degree of cultural panic among traditionalists. So although, you know, certainly on issues like gay rights, you know, this philosophy is fading. But you're still talking about, you know, probably the major voting bloc in the Republican Party.
I'm speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who is a senior writer for the Daily Beast / Newsweek. And you know, people sometimes think there's a contradiction between the Christian right side and the free market side, but you said earlier that that's not really the case. How do they reconcile these perhaps contradictory impulses?
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm not sure that they necessarily see them as contradictory. Again, I think it's not contradictory if you imagine the kind of goal of society as fostering the freedom of men to rule their families as they see fit, and even to rule their kind of communities as they see fit. And I think you can add to that, you know, the emergence of the prosperity gospel, which basically holds that God rewards the righteous through riches, and so money and worldly success is a sign of God's favor. You know, Mormonism has actually had something to do. Mormonism and the prosperity gospel are kind of very different in a lot of ways, but both of them link spiritual success and worldly success.
That's an ancient American Protestant theme, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so, again, I think that, so for example, you know, it often seems kind of baffling, I think, from a secular perspective, that, you know, how can you kind of consider taxes to be theft, but believe that the state has the right to force women to have children against their will? Whereas what I think people on the Christian right, I think people on the Christian right see both as forms of, they see both kind of high taxes and legalized abortion as forms of federal government tyranny. You know, one is kind of the government taking from you, and the other is the government of stripping you of the right to control your family and your community.
Ryan is making a pilgrimage to see Sheldon Adelson in Vegas. What is the role of a kind of Likudnik Zionism to the Christian right these days?
Well, on the one hand, I mean, the Christian right, you know, supports a much more hawkish position on Israel than the vast majority of American Jews. I mean, you certainly have a lot of kind of very rich Jewish donors, you know, Sheldon Adelson being a perfect example, who's, you know, who kind of want to see American politicians completely subservient to the Likud in Israel, or at least who see the two, who see America and right-wing Israeli interests as being indistinguishable. But there aren't that many Jews in the United States, and the vast majority of Jews are pretty liberal and support a two-state solution. And so I don't think you could have this stranglehold on Middle Eastern policy without a huge number of evangelicals who, for theological reasons, believe that, you know, a two-state solution is not just kind of unjust, but will frustrate their, you know, will kind of frustrate the return of Christ and the dawning of paradise on earth.
Yeah, what is the theological angle on this?
It's called premillennial dispensationalism, and it basically holds that it reads into the book of Revelation and various other biblical prophecies a series of events which will unfold in various orders depending on who you're talking to, but usually it starts with the rise of a charismatic antichrist. In the past, that was sometimes seen as the Pope in the Left Behind novels, which are, you know, these fantastically popular end times books by Timothy LaHaye. The Antichrist was the Secretary General of the United Nations. You know, now, of course, many evangelicals see the Antichrist as Barack Obama. This person will usher in all sorts of, he will, under the guise of making peace, usher in a one world government, you know, the mark of the beast. You know, sometimes they see legalized abortion as, again, kind of part of the Antichrist's final plan. At some point during this drama, there will be a rapture when true believers will, you know, be carried up to heaven and leave kind of everybody else to suffer through the tribulation. In this scenario, there is a third world war in the Middle East, you know, centering on the biblical site of Megiddo or Armageddon. And one of the important things to mention here is that it's certainly not true that all evangelicals or all premillennial dispensationalists want to actively bring on a third world war in the Middle East. But it's certainly not something to be avoided at all costs, because it's a kind of necessary step on the road to Jesus' return and the establishment of 1,000 years of heaven on earth. And so there will be this third world war in the Middle East. This will usher in the return of Jesus Christ. One of the preconditions for all of these events to unfold is Jews returning to the entire biblical state of Israel. And so, you know, after, once this third world war commences, those who haven't found Jesus Christ will all be consigned to a bloody, fiery death and then the pits of hell. But for now, they have a very, they have basically an identical agenda with the kind of most fanatical of Israeli settlers.
It's really kind of like a one-night stand, though, this relation with the Jews.
Well, I think, you know, Leon Wieseltier, I think, called it a grim comedy of mutual contempt, and I think that that's a good way to put it.
What does the choice of Ryan by Romney say to you about Romney?
I think it says that Romney is, well, you know, it's always been almost impossible to kind of figure out what Romney really believes because he's so incredibly changeable. What it says to me is one of two things, and I honestly don't know which is true. Either he really has been incredibly right-wing all along, and his moderation in Massachusetts was an act, or he's just a kind of empty person who is completely intimidated and enthralled to the right of his own party, you know, to the right wing of his own party, and so felt like it was more important to mollify them than to choose somebody who could actually help him win the election.
And you can't make up your mind which it is.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he's kind of a cipher. I have no sense of who Romney really is, or to what Romney, aside from Romney's belief that he should be president, I don't have really the slightest idea what his ideological convictions are.
Now, you can't say the same of Ryan, so is he going to end up dominating the ticket?
I mean, I think so. I think he was, you know, in a sense, he was already kind of dominating the ticket because, you know, because Romney has been so incredibly reluctant to release any specifics about his fiscal policies, you know, or kind of actually about any of his policies. People had been basically imputing the Ryan budget to him because he said he supported it. And so, you know, certainly by choosing Ryan, it makes it seem as if that's a pretty good assumption, right? I mean, in as much as we're kind of trying to figure out what would Romney do as president, this seems to be the best guide that we have.
And what's your guess? Are they going to try to keep the social reaction under wraps and just leave with the economic reaction, or will the social policy figure prominently in the campaign?
You know, I thought they were going to just lead with the economic reaction. I mean, that initially seemed to be the strategy, but then you saw Romney just, I think, a week or two ago come out with these ads accusing Obama of waging a war on religion. And so my sense is that they will try to speak to different audiences in different, you know, kind of different idioms, but that's increasingly hard to do in the age of the internet. You know, I don't think that they want to spend a lot of time talking about abortion and birth control, but they've certainly seemed willing to go on the offensive about it so far.
And, of course, it's an important part of the base that likes to hear all those lunatic things.
Right, to a certain extent, I wonder if the fact that they've chosen Ryan takes the pressure off Romney to say those kind of things because, you know, when there was still a lot of doubt in the base about Romney's social conservative bona fides, he needed those kind of ads to gin them up. You know, in a way, Ryan so reassures them because he's so well known to them, if not to the rest of the country, for his extreme social conservatism, that it means that they don't have to be quite so loud about it.
I was Michelle Goldberg, a writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and the author of two books, Kingdom Coming and The Means of Reproduction. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the Piano Quintet by Anton Webern, an early work written when he was 24, performed by the Ensemble Intercontemporain, founded by Pierre Boulez, whose collection of the complete Webern this performance comes from. Next up, Charles Giuntica. I first learned of Giuntica back in 1992 when I wrote a piece for The Nation magazine on bankruptcy, which I described then as in the midst of a boom. That year, 3.4 out of every 1,000 people filed for bankruptcy, more than three times the rate of 20 years earlier. In 2010, just as we were sort of emerging from the Great Recession, almost 5 per 1,000 filed, an increase of over 40% from 1992. The credit industry would have you believe that the reason for the bankruptcy boom is a spreading moral rot. People just don't take their debt seriously anymore. That's nonsense, of course. As Giuntica told me 20 years ago, and you'll hear him say again in a few minutes, debtors contemplate bankruptcy only after enormous suffering. Now, the major reason for the increase in bankruptcy is the massive increase in consumer debt over the last several decades. And when you're deep in debt, and you lose a job, get divorced, or get sick, you may find that what was once an almost tolerable burden becomes totally intolerable. You just can't pay. And if that happens, collection agents will prey upon you, you will be tortured by guilt, and your life will become a living hell. Historically, American law was very debtor-friendly by international standards. The idea was always in this country that if we wanted to encourage growth and entrepreneurship, we shouldn't be too hard on borrowers to get in over their heads. That began to change in the 1990s as the bankruptcy boom boomed on. Financiers began lobbying for a tightening of the bankruptcy code. Attempts to get a bill through Congress foundered at the end of the decade, but success finally came in 2005. There are several major changes in the reform legislation. Most importantly, a means test was imposed for the first time. There are two major options open to individuals filing for bankruptcy. Chapter 7, named after the section of the law, which allows for debts to be wiped away completely, and Chapter 13, which consolidates multiple debts and imposes a repayment plan on bankrupts. By debts, I mean mostly credit cards. You can't get rid of tax debt or student debt in a bankruptcy. In the old days, before the reform, petitioners were allowed to choose which path to take. But with the 2005 reform, the Chapter 7 total erasure option was eliminated for debtors with incomes above their state average. Also, the 2005 reform imposed stricter documentation requirements and substantially raised the cost of filing. From the industry's point of view, the reform was a success. In the year or two leading up to the passage of the legislation, filing spiked, hitting nearly 7 per 1,000 in 2005. They collapsed the following year to just 2 per 1,000. They crept higher again during the recession, but this year they're running around 4 per 1,000. According to a little statistical model I developed, had the relationship between debt and bankruptcy filings that prevailed before 2005 continued to today, the rate of bankruptcy filings would be 1.5 times as high as they are now, close to 6 per 1,000. But they could be much higher even. About 2% of credit card holders are behind in payments. The industry is writing off 4 or 5% of outstanding balances as uncollectible. In other words, one could easily imagine a bankruptcy rate 5 or 10 times current levels. I almost never give personal financial advice, but I'll make an exception in this case. If you've got a serious credit card problem, please seriously consider filing for bankruptcy. Of course, you should see a lawyer if you can afford one. I'm not qualified to give legal advice, but really, don't let fear hold you back. Getting rid of all that debt will be liberating, and the banks can afford it. Okay, now on to my interview with Charles Giuntica. Giuntica runs a small law practice in Manhattan that's devoted almost exclusively to personal bankruptcy. He's an evangelist for going chapter, as they say in Texas. Charles Giuntica. Is there any reason why someone facing a very heavy burden of credit card debt shouldn't contemplate filing for bankruptcy?
Well, no. In fact, I mean, the upside is huge. You know, people typically ask me, what are the advantages and disadvantages? If you're overwhelmed with debt and have no substantial assets, there is no downside. You can, by extinguishing the debt with Chapter 7 bankruptcy, you basically are given a clean slate. And you can recover a good credit rating in about 2 years. It is not 7 or 10 years. It never was. That is a myth.
Okay, so there are certain kinds of debt that, of course, not eligible for extinguishment, right?
But yes, this will eliminate credit card debt. You know, unsecured loans, hospital debt, you know, that sort of thing. Now, there are categories of debt that you cannot eliminate, primarily student loans and recent taxes. lot of stuff related to government, generally speaking.
And there are two major options for someone approaching this, right? Chapter 7 and 13. What are the details of each?
Yeah, well, under Chapter 7, you get to wipe out the debt entirely. In order to qualify for that, your income should be below the median or maybe just above the median for your state. Your debt needs to be substantial, and of course, you wouldn't be even looking into it if it wasn't. And you have no substantial assets. So those three things, limited income, high debt, and no substantial assets, qualifies you for Chapter 7. And I might add that Chapter 7 is very, very important and useful because it really gives you the ability to start over again, the way a company would start over again. General Motors eliminated billions in debt with their bankruptcy, and they've recovered quite nicely, and people can recover. Okay, in terms of recovering after the bankruptcy, the credit card industry actually floods you with new credit cards when a bankruptcy is over because they're looking to get you in trouble again. And what I tell my clients is I would love to tell you not to have the credit cards, but we have a bad system in America because everybody looks for that credit score. You know, they all want to see a 700 credit score when you apply for jobs, apartments. So you should have credit cards, but only have like two. And when you charge, just charge a few hundred, maybe just for food, and then pay it off. And that builds up the score. But the problem comes in with the business plan that the banks have for credit cards because the management of the banks, their whole idea is to lend money to broke people or people who are struggling. And it sounds weird when you say it that way, but it's smart and evil at the same time. I mean, because what happens is by lending money to people with lower incomes or people struggling, that people are desperate. They end up borrowing too much. They start them at a low interest rate. Once they borrow too much, then they jack up the interest. And so it's essentially a trap. And what I tell my clients is for your future credit, when you have the credit cards and something happens, a trigger event, you go to the dentist wants $1,000. You know, it's embarrassing to ask your family for the dentist money or your friends. It's embarrassing to look at the dentist and say, can I pay $100 a month? Be embarrassed. Don't ask the devil credit card. They'll lend you $1,000, they'll lend you $2,000, and you end up paying back $4,000 or $5,000 with the interest.
Chapter 13, the debts are not wiped out. How many hoops do you have to jump through in that one?
Well, for those people whose incomes are more upper middle class, they will not allow you to do Chapter 7, but they'll let you do Chapter 13, which is also very, very good. Because, see, under Chapter 13, the debts are consolidated by the bankruptcy court. And the interest is essentially eliminated. And then the debts are spread out over three, four, or five years. And then you write one check to the judge, and then the judge pays everyone off. And you can also include your legal fees as part of the payment plan, so you don't have to come up with too much money to pay your lawyer. So Chapter 13 is a wonderful thing. You know, in a way, Chapter 13 is debt reorganization by the court. So it's kind of, and it works. It's kind of like those guys on TV who say that they're going to help you with your debts and they always rip you off. This has the effect of law. This is the judge reorganizing the debts. So it really works, unlike the guys on TV who I never saw one that was legitimate.
The 2005 bankruptcy reform was a fairly large departure out of American history. American history has been rather debtor-friendly, and then suddenly it went pretty debtor-hostile. What changed in 2005?
Well, what changed in 2005 is essentially two things. The law was changed and rewritten by the credit card companies, and so it made filing for bankruptcy more work. So the cost of filing bankruptcy essentially doubled. It went from including the court costs from about an average of $1,400, $1,500 per case to really around $2,000 per case. And, you know, I hasten to add that, you know, we charge much less than that. We view this as, it's a public service. I mean, we make a good living, but we charge quite a bit less than a normal attorney. But Most attorneys, because of the amount of work, had to raise their prices substantially. And so people who are very limited means, at the very bottom, find that they don't have access to the bankruptcy laws anymore. So maybe 5-10% of the people who really are earning minimum wage have a hard time raising the money to file, and they've made it so complicated that it's much more difficult for people to do it on their own. And on the other part of the spectrum, the upper and middle income people have difficulty filing Chapter 7. They're pushed into 13. And I'd say about 5% of people who I used to do 7s for have now earned too much money, so they are pushed into Chapter 13, which is a very bad thing in many ways, because you can be making above the median and still be really struggling. Like here locally, I mean, you can be earning in New York City. You can be earning, like say the mom earns $45,000, is a teacher, and she's married to a police officer who's just starting out making $40,000. So it appears they're making a lot of money, but when you add 3 or 4 kids into the mix, they're barely getting along. And if either one has been out of work for say a year, the laid off teacher perhaps, they can build up such a large amount of debt, and they're working again, thank God, but they can't do Chapter 7. So they have to, so they're budgeted for a payment, say $600 a month in a Chapter 13. Boy, that makes their budget really hard when you have 3 kids. You know, in New York City, very high, very expensive place to live, and you look at other major metropolitan areas, you've got the same problem. So at the high end, some nice middle income people who are swamped with debt through no fault of their own from unemployment or medical problems, and they're lucky enough to be working again, they've got to do that 4 or 5 year plan. And at the very bottom end, you got a single mom making minimum wage, no child support. She had to raise $1,800, $1,900 to do a bankruptcy. It's very tough for them.
Now, the 2005 law also now requires debtors contemplating bankruptcy to go through a credit counseling course?
Yes. The debtors now are required to do a credit counseling course, but it can be done on the Internet or over the phone, and also a second, what they call an education course, which is similar to the credit counseling course. And these are like all of these hoops that they started to require people to jump through that were not required previously. Those courses are just part of it. People have to come up with all their pay stubs going back at least 6 months. People have to come up with, bank statements. And some people, don't keep all their pay stubs going back. And you have to come up with 2 tax returns, not just the most recent year, 2 years. And so they just added a lot of individual requirements that didn't really exist prior to that.
I'm speaking with Charles Giuntica, who is the leading bankruptcy attorney in Manhattan. Now, these counseling services, from the looks of them, some of them seem to be funded by the credit card industry.
Yes. These credit counselors are really bad news. Now, mind you, when it's done for bankruptcy, they generally have not abused the system. But they are the same people who do those ads on television saying that we're going to help you, and they claim to be nonprofit. And when they do the payment plan with you, after a year or two, you realize that the debts aren't going down, and you find out that the deals they've made aren't quite what they promised. And in some cases, they didn't make the deal at all. And all of a sudden, you're finding yourself sued. And then you find that the people who have been getting money, the credit card people, they actually send money back under the table, essentially, because they don't tell people that they get this money that comes back to what claims to be the nonprofit people. And the nonprofit people, of course, hire for-profit companies that are set up by like their wife to process the paperwork. I mean, the owners of a lot of these credit counseling companies are become like multimillionaires. And actually, we've sued my firm along with other firms that we work with. I've actually sued a bunch of these credit counselors and put them out of business, essentially, but they're kind of like cockroaches. I mean, you shut these guys down, and then their brother opens one in a different state. And, of course, they never operate in the same state. Like, we here in New York, we deal with some credit counselors that are established in Arizona, but they won't do any Arizona work because it's too easy to sue them by an Arizona resident. And, you know, some are in California, but they won't do a California resident. They'll do New York residents. They never operate in the state that they're in because they're kind of shady.
They sound like they operate at the same level as payday lenders.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember one of them, there were congressional hearings on this a few years back, and we got wind of it, and then we did a little research about, you know, the multi-million dollar homes of these guys and some of the bad things they did, and we were actually able to get to the congressional staffers and various presidents of various companies like this were being there, and the guy who was there, I guess, thought that he was going to be there as one of the reputable ones, not realizing that somebody had investigated him. And we were able to get the documents to the congressional aides, and it was nice to see somebody getting their comeuppance. You know, it doesn't happen enough, but they stayed in operation. So, and quite, it got to the point, quite frankly, because I'm basically a bankruptcy attorney, I couldn't continue to shut these places down and still do my work. But really, that should be the purview of the attorney general.
Now, you talked a little bit about this earlier, but the credit industry circulates horror tales about what will happen to you if you file for bankruptcy. They say it's, you know, it's financially very damaging and emotionally very wrenching. What's your reaction to these claims?
My reaction to these claims is that they're wrong and that these guys are full of it. People, if they keep their new credit cards in check, never, and I tell clients, never owe more than 500 ever again on your credit cards. You can get your credit score back in the 700 region in 2 years. People get mortgages in 3 years. And what they did go through, it was traumatic. You know, owing the money and doing the bankruptcy, I admit that. But afterwards, they don't look like the same people. The debt is gone. The stress has gone away. They've gotten sleep. Like when I see people the second and third times as the bankruptcy is over, we bring them in for counseling, I don't even recognize them. I mean, they're sitting up straighter, their faces look better, and then as they build up their credit and they're getting mortgages, it's just great to see.
The industry also likes to say, and some academics who work for them agree, that that the rise in bankruptcy over the last couple of decades is a result of a kind of spreading moral laxity, that people just don't take their debt seriously anymore. Is that what you see when you have clients coming in?
No. In fact, I'm glad you asked me that question. The last figure I saw, I think, put out by Visa, is that about 2% of their customers file bankruptcy. And it should be a lot more. And let me tell you, the main reason people don't file is they feel bad. They feel guilty. They say to themselves, oh, I borrowed money, I should pay back, almost like they borrowed from friends. They have no conception that the banking management intentionally lent them money because they knew they were only making $35,000 a year and had two kids. They knew that they would be desperate and borrow too much. They knew they would start them off with 12% interest. And then, as they saw that they borrowed 5%, bump it up to 29%. They were trapped. It was an intentional trap. Right now in New York City, in my estimate, of the 8 million people who live here, I bet you 2 million could come in and file bankruptcy with me or some other lawyer. They don't do it. I mean, less than 5%, far less, file bankruptcy across the country. That number could be as high as 50, 60 million people. They don't do it. And it's because of the guilt. And if they realize the truth of the matter, I mean, those people should file bankruptcy. It would serve these banks right. Let me tell you another story. I started practicing this area of law in the mid-80s. Come around 1990, I was visited by a banking research firm. And these two guys came unannounced to my office. They're in the waiting room, and they wanted to see me, and so I was happy to see them. And they said, well, we've been retained by a major bank because they had a plan. They were thinking of of raising the interest rates, as I was just discussing, raising the interest rates on people who borrowed a large amount, and that even though they were paying on time, they were timely payers, that once they hit a large amount of debt, $5,000, $8,000, they were going to change the interest rate. And what did I think of that? They were a research outfit, and they were doing original research. They had their little cards and business suits on. And I said, well, I think this is a great idea for my business because you will drive people into bankruptcy. And in fact, bankruptcies did go up. But they didn't, percentage-wise, they didn't go up anywhere near the amount that it probably should have if people would contemplate doing this. They don't do it. They pay. They pay for years. They pay 5 years, 10 years. Money that they literally borrowed 5 years ago when they were out of work. And so many people pay. And you know what they call these people? They call these people revolvers. That's the term of art in the credit card business. People who pay the minimum payments or just above the minimum payments. The people who pay in full are called deadbeats. And the end result is that the credit card departments, according to a study by the University of Maryland, make 54% net profit. Did you hear that? 54% net profit, according to University of Maryland study. Now, the most successful venture capitalist, if he averages 20%, is considered a god. But this is not talked about. Obviously, they do not want people to publicize this. But it fits right in with what the banks have become. And they are robber barons. And they have now managed to bring down the whole economy, and nobody has gone to jail. And all the depression regulations are not there. And when it comes to credit cards, I just want to say one thing. One of the biggest regulations was every state had a cap on interest rates of about 6 or 7%. And that, if a bank president charged consumers 10%, he would go to jail. There were restrictions on interest rates. In 1978, the Supreme Court knocked out those restrictions. And that's when these things started happening. So if every regulation has been reduced or watered down, you know, the worst aspects of human nature with these people, you know, their greed has come to the fore, and anybody of my parents' generation could have predicted it. Anybody who lived through the Great Depression. And, you know, those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it, but I never thought I was going to see it in my lifetime. But it's been the bane of my career, and I would like to see it end before my career is over.
Just looking at the bankruptcy numbers, there was a run-up in filings as the laws about to change in 2004, 2005, and then they collapsed, and they've come back some, but they're still below the highs of 5 or 10 years ago. And so the industry has pretty much gotten what it wanted out of this reform, hasn't it?
Yes, in many ways they've made money off this reform because the people who need the help the most at the bottom can't afford to file. And the people at people with the upper middle incomes, making $70,000, $80,000 as a family, are having to pay some of the money back. And so instead of having money for their kids for school and clothes and whatnot, it goes to the banker's bottom line. And the people at the bottom who are earning minimum wage get their wages garnished, so they literally don't have food on the table for their kids. They should really be proud of themselves. It's just gosh awful, and something's got to change. And with any luck, you know, if the political process works again someday, you know, that will happen.
And finally, like people who are deeply in debt, obviously don't have a lot of money to pay for lawyers and court fees. What can people do if they're, you know, don't have a pennies to scrape together?
Well, if you approach your bar associations, the local bar associations, almost at least every county I know of, you know, here in the New York, New Jersey area, has a pro bono, like kind of legal services plan. The only problem is, instead of there's such a long waiting line that you might wait 6 months, 8 months, 10 months for the case to be processed. If you can get a local bar association, call them. Reach out to them. If they don't do it, they can usually refer you to a kind of free legal services plan. The court costs are now, don't just, if you're just paying the core costs, which I think these programs sometimes want you to do, you know, are a couple hundred bucks. You know, I think there's a system where your fee can be waived or spread out over time. The core fee is $306, but you're allowed to pay it in increments, I think, of $75 over a series of months. That's the way to go. Approach your bar association. They'll point you to these various programs. It may take a while, but, you know, hey, you know, as long as that you get accepted, that's, you know, they're great things.
That was Charles Gentica, who handles more cases of personal bankruptcy than the other lawyer in Manhattan. Although bankruptcy is regulated under federal law, details vary from state to state, so please consult a local lawyer or bar association. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go on with this, some of the Raincoat's Life on the Line from 1979. Till next week, bye.